So your economy has collapsed. That's okay, it happens. Your treasury is depleted. Your currency has been hyperinflated beyond usefulness. Shelves are empty. Utilities are failing. Businesses can't operate even if they had someone to sell to. And the government workers still showing up to do their job are on borrowed time before they have to start looking after themselves and their own families. It's not great, but the good news is there are plenty of countries that have been here before, and there are actually entire groups that specialize in restarting dead economies. So your economy has collapsed. What do you do now?
Some sections of the Centro San Vid look like a ghost town.
You need this amount of money to buy this cup of coffee.
Zimbabwe's unsustainable debt situation.
Argentines can only legally buy $200 a month at the official exchange rate.
But a major problem is that the government spends more than it has.
Sri Lanka is defaulting on its debt in just the latest sign of the nation's escalating economic collapse.
If your country can't pay its debts, then it's technically bankrupt. But in reality, that doesn't actually mean anything. In the words of the great Oscar Martinez, you can't just say the word bankruptcy and expect anything to happen. When a sovereign nation can no longer pay its debts, it's very different from an individual or a business which can be taken to court and legally forced to sell off their assets to try and pay back their debts. There is no international body with that kind of authority over independent countries, which is both a good thing and a bad thing. The good news is nobody is going to come and repossess your national assets. Probably. Beyond the practical limitations of seizing something like a road network or an electrical grid in a foreign country, the national debt is usually made up of bonds owed to thousands or millions of other governments, businesses, and individuals. Even if it was possible to take control of national assets without resorting to military force, doing this wouldn't really help those bondholders get paid. It would only serve to punish the people of the country and make it harder for them to rebuild. There are exceptions to this rule, though. The Hambantota port in Sri Lanka became the country's second largest shipping port after it was opened in late 2010. The construction was financed directly through a special loan from the Chinese government, and construction was conducted by the state-owned China Harbor Engineering Company. The country's later economic collapse meant that it defaulted on this loan, but unlike regular government debt, this loan was tied directly to the port as an asset to secure the debt. After back-and-forth negotiations, control of the port was eventually handed over to the Hambantota International Port Group, a new company which was 85% owned by China Merchant Ports, a company which itself is majority owned by the China Merchants Group, a state-owned company controlled exclusively by the Chinese Ministry of Transport. The group also established a special economic zone around the port which would enable Chinese ships to store their cargo here along strategically important trade routes without needing to pay the usual fees and taxes. The Chinese government has also used the port for its military-style vessels, causing tensions between basically every government in the region. This one port is often cited as the golden example of a strategy known as debt trap diplomacy. A wealthy country will loan a poor country money for a big project. If they repay the money, that's great. And if they don't, then the wealthy country gets to take a vital piece of infrastructure for themselves, which for them is also great. The reality is, though, that this is exceedingly rare. The international backlash is simply not worth the gain. What's more is that if a country is so unstable that it can't pay its debts at all, it's just as likely to nationalize the infrastructure, and then, unless the lender is willing to defend their asset by military force, there isn't really much they can do. The port of Hambantota is a rare example where assets were handed over, but even being run by a foreign company, the Sri Lankan government has maintained that the benefits of the project massively outweigh the costs. Now, of course, they would say that, but today the port provides thousands of local jobs, connects a developing economy with global trade routes, and they don't even need to pay for its upkeep. The point is, if your economy fails and you can't make the repayments on your debt, it's unlikely that the people you owe money to will be able to do much about it. The bad news is that those people aren't going to lend you any more money. You might think the last thing a country that's gone bankrupt would need is to take on even more debt. But this is often the case. Without cash, your economy won't be able to fund basic services, which can have immediate consequences beyond strictly economics. The inconvenient truth about debt crises is that they rarely happen in total isolation. Investors lending money to governments know that they don't have much recourse if that government can't pay. These lenders, which are mainly other governments or extremely large institutions, employ teams of highly paid economists to assess a government's ability to repay their loans, just like a bank manager might assess the average person's ability to pay a mortgage. If either is deemed to be too much of a credit risk, they are unlikely to get the money. That means unless the lenders have messed up their calculations, most defaults are the result of some kind of unforeseen circumstances. For an average person and their mortgage, that might be something like losing their job or getting sick. For an entire economy, it could be anything from government corruption, natural disasters, wars, and coups, all the way up to something like a wider global downturn. All of these can, and have, caused countries to default on their debts in the past. But just for fun, let's say your economy has been hit with a massive natural disaster. The first step in recovery is then dealing with the underlying problem first. And to do that, you need money. Since you are the government, you can just print some of your own money, but that's only going to get you so far. New money can pay for some services in the local economy for a while, but without effective taxation or resources to get that money back out of circulation, you're quickly going to end up with hyperinflation. Extreme inflation has gone hand in hand with most major economic collapses over the last century, because printing money can keep things going for a little while, but more long-term solutions will need to be found fast, or else you're only going to make things worse. Your money hot off the printing press is also going to be practically useless to pay for imports. If you need to purchase machinery to repair an electrical grid that was damaged in the disaster, then there are only a few suppliers you can go to anywhere in the world. Something like an F-35G gas-insulated substation is only produced by General Electric in the USA, and they only accept a small handful of international currencies. If your country has defaulted on its debts and is already trying to print its way out of trouble, your currency is not going to be accepted by the kind people at GE. So to fix the problems that are stopping you from fixing your economy, you're going to need real, hard currency. This itself is a problem because by defaulting on your loans, you've angered the people who would typically have financed your debt. But there are other sources for economies in your situation. Since your economic collapse was triggered by a natural disaster, independent aid organizations like the Red Cross and certain government-backed operations like USAID can provide humanitarian assistance on the ground. Although, maybe don't count on that too much right now. But no matter how generous these organizations are, they are not going to rebuild national infrastructure or recapitalize domestic industries. They're just going to do their best to make sure people get food, shelter, and medical attention. To do much more, you're going to need to borrow money to fund rebuilding efforts. And by this point, the only group left that's going to work with you is the global lender of last resort, the International Monetary Fund. The IMF is the financial agency of the United Nations, and one of its key functions is to lend money to countries in crisis so they can hopefully get back on their feet. The agency collects money from its 191 member states and uses that to provide lending to countries that can't get loans from anywhere else so they can make strategic investments and turn themselves around. The money is still a loan, so there's the expectation that it will be repaid. But there's also a reason why nobody else is lending this money, which is that often failing economies can't be turned around, and that money will never come back. So you might be thinking then, why would all those countries give money to the IMF to bail out someone else if it's such a bad risk-reward proposition? Well, the stated idea of the organization is that it's better to give a failing country an opportunity to turn itself around than to have it fail entirely, which could cause wider financial problems, refugee crises, combat and trade disruptions for the rest of the world. The actual reason is that it gives rich countries a lot of influence. Member countries get to vote on how and when the IMF takes action, and votes are based largely on how much money each member makes available. The country with the most voting power by far is the USA, which has caused some controversies. The IMF has been accused in the past of helping out regimes that are friendly with the big voting powers and letting unfriendly countries fail so that new powers could take their place. There's also the moral question that often comes up with failing states of when it's actually better to let them die. The IMF has in the past provided loans to dictatorships in places like Uganda, Romania, Chile, and Zaire. These crisis loans have helped these governments hold on to power when otherwise they may have crumbled, allowing something better to take their place. It doesn't help that corrupt dictatorships are much more likely to find themselves with collapsing economies than robust democracies, so these tough decisions need to be made. It's certainly not perfect, but as your economy is crumbling around you, there aren't many options left. You need to go hat in hand and try and arrange a bailout loan. The IMF will normally approve loans on such grounds, but it's going to come with strings attached. The IMF won't just hand over a lump sum of money to a failing state. They will break it up bit by bit, and the organization has a set list of 10 specific conditions that countries must meet in order to keep getting loans. Those rules are fiscal policy discipline. The country needs to raise taxes and lower unnecessary spending. Redirection of public funds away from subsidies, introducing broad and marginal income taxes, interest rates which are market determined, currency value that is market determined, not set by government, trade liberalization like getting rid of tariffs and import quotas, the privatization of state enterprises, deregulating of businesses, and finally, security to protect private property rights. These 10 conditions were originally published in the late 1980s by the economist John Williamson for a think tank based in Washington. These 10 commandments to fix a broken economy are now known as the Washington Consensus and form the framework for how the IMF gives out loans. Following these rules should help a government free up cash flows, which will not only help to pay its debts, but it should also support local market activity. Critics argue that these instructions should be simplified and rewritten as just embrace global capitalism or else. It's a difficult trade-off because if your failing economy had no guidelines on how the money could be spent, you would be much less likely to pay it back and much more likely to repeat the same mistakes that got you here in the first place. The natural disaster that wiped out your local infrastructure may have been outside your control, but the IMF would argue that a more robust economy could have dealt with the shock without folding in on itself. Regardless of whose fault it really is, you, as the leader of this failed economy, are unlikely to hold on to power unless you really hold on to it. You're probably going to get voted out of office, and that's okay. Statistically, countries that can peacefully transfer power to a new leadership following a crisis are much more likely to recover and prosper. And you can spend your retirement relaxing and watching videos like this one on the incredible logistics of a generic 40-foot shipping container. Make sure to like and subscribe for more micro stories with big impacts.